Members, we do have a quorum, so if you would take your seats and direct your attention, we will get started with the meeting officially. The Community Legislative Assistant will note the roll as you come in. We do have the minutes in front of us. Someone has been looking at the minutes. I saw that and could move the adoption of the minutes. Representative Szymanski moves the minutes. Discussion to the minutes. Seeing none, let's vote. All in favor signify by aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you. Members, first bill on the agenda today is House File 2136. Representative Sanders is not here yet. So we could proceed with another one. Representative Vogel, you have number two on the agenda for today. And I think I see your testifier in the audience. Would you be prepared to go ahead and tee this one up, and we'll go from there. And Representative Vogel, this one will be referred to the General Register.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's correct. I move House File 2187 to be passed and sent to the General Register.
Okay.
I also have an amendment.
An amendment?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay.
DE2, delete all. I would move the amendment.
Just a moment. The Chair is digging for the amendment here. The DE2 amendment. Representative Sanders, I'm sorry, Vogel, excuse me. Can you tell us how much different this is, or one of your testifiers, the DE2, from the original bill as introduced?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I'll ask Jacob Milner to explain that to you.
Great. Jacob, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, and tell us about the DE2 amendment. We'd appreciate that.
My name is Jacob Milner, and I'm with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Mr. Chair, representatives, the DE2 amendment is divided into three sections, and if it's okay, I'll go through each section take a few minutes to go through each section.
Please.
Section one would allow the auto dealers additional flexibility to provide secure storage for license plates and stickers when using the optional computerized vehicle registration system. And this is new to the amendment. Several years ago, the auto dealers, DVS, and the deputy registrar came together in a public-private partnership, which created a computerized vehicle registration system in which the dealer and the deputy registrar do the paperwork for the customer on a vehicle title. Using this optional system, the consumer receives their title generally within 7 to 10 days. What we're noticing is kind of a plateau in dealers who are willing to get on the CVR system, and we want to encourage greater participation in the system. Oftentimes, the dealers have cited to us the statute which requires the plating and stickering of cars at the time of sale as the primary reason not to get on the CVR system. What Section 1 will be to tweak the current law by removing the requirement that the vehicle license plate and registration sticker must be attached to the vehicle at the time of sale when using the CVR system. And this, we hope, will allow dealers to provide better control over their inventory of plates and stickers, and which should assuage some of their fears, hopefully getting more dealers on the system, which will have more consumers use the system and take some of the burden off of DVS in terms to title to get titles out to customers quicker in the state. Section 2 would create a more efficient bonded title procedure for odd titles. Sometimes we have a situation where a customer trades in a vehicle and the title has problems that make it impossible for dealers to rectify, thereby preventing the sale of these vehicles that the dealer is holding. Currently, if a customer trades in a vehicle that lists an owner on the title that can't be located, a dealer must incur a costly, time-consuming procedure and have it to go to court to make a case for a clear title before the dealer can then sell the car. Oftentimes, the car isn't worth the cost, but it's still a good car and should be put back in the stream of commerce. So we lose these cars. This bill or this section would create a more efficient and cheaper process for the dealer when dealing with these tricky titles. The dealer could avoid going to court and the costly expense, which I said wasn't justified oftentimes, by signing an affidavit to the department saying that they've exercised due diligence trying to find the owner, and then posting a bond worth 1.5 times the value of the vehicle to obtain the clean license. This will then allow dealers to get a title and get the car back into the stream of commerce. If the owner of the vehicle does come forward, they'll be protected because they'll be able to make a claim on the bond, and this will only be available for vehicles which are older than 5 years. Lastly, Section 3, is similar but different, will allow auto dealers the ability to obtain an old lien release on behalf of customers. Currently in law, if an individual has paid off their lien in full but is unable to locate the lien holder to obtain a lien release, current law permits that person to send a letter by certified mail, return receipt requested, to the lien holder, and then present this as evidence to the department that they were unable to find the lien holder. The department then will issue a lien release. This is only available, I should mention, on vehicles which are 7 years older or more. All we're looking to do is allow dealers a little bit more flexibility by allowing them to obtain a lien release in a similar manner that individuals already can, so that we can do the work for the consumer. So I stand for questions.
Thank you, Jacob, for your presentation. Representative Vogel.
All right. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the DE2 amendment and ask for it to be adopted.
Members, let's move that. Now that we've had it explained to us, let's move the amendment put the bill in the shape the author wishes. Excuse me. Further discussion, DE2. Seeing none, let's vote. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Members, the amendment prevails. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The bill is now in the shape you'd like. Members, I'd like to point out that there are a couple of issues here that we should pay attention to, particularly, the three sections. You've had them explained very clearly to you. We've talked about them before in years past. This is going to the General Register, and it's moving in the Senate as well.
Yes,
Representative.
It's already. Yep.
Okay. Is there discussion to the bill as amended? Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Milner, just a quick question. Is the summary sheet provided by MADA in our packets speaking to the bill as presented or to the DE2 amendment?
The research summary sheet that looks like this, Representative Vogel.
Excuse me. No, Mr. Chair. I wasn't talking about that. I was talking about the MADA support sheet.
Thank you for the clarification.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, yes. The answer is yes.
To the DE2 amendment?
To the DE2, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Milner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions of these witnesses before I open up witnesses from the audience? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for, against, or about this bill? Anyone? It seems like you've done good work, Ms. Schlander, and getting a bill that can be workable and help move auto dealing along into the 21st century. Appreciate that very much. Mm-hmm. Further questions? Seeing none, members, Representative Vogel renews his motion.
Yes.
That see House File 2187 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor signify by aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. You're on your way to the General Register with this
Thank
bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative, if you'd like to stay right there, I still don't see Representative Sanders in the room. Okay. I think he has another committee. If you'd like to pick up your other file, and we can talk about design build projects.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vogel, if you move the bill, this one also is being re-referred to the General Register.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2378 to be passed and sent to the General Register.
Okay.
I do have an amendment as well, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you move the amendment,
okay,
Representative?
The A-12 amendment. Mr. Chair, I move that it be passed and adopted.
Okay. Give me just a moment here. I get my paperwork straight in front of me. The pages are handing out more stuff for us to consider. Yes, you have the H-12 689 amendment.
Yes.
That's the motion.
Yes.
This technical in nature?
It's just technical in nature. It actually makes the rest of the bill conforming to the first section effective date in the bill on line or page 1, lines 14 and 15. This just carries that wording through the rest of the bill. So it just makes it all conforming to the same.
Outstanding. Questions to the 689 amendment? Seeing none, let's vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. House Bill 2378 as amended is in front of us, Representative. You have witnesses, I see.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I'd like to introduce them at this point. I have Doug Fisher here and Tom Honish as well.
Mr. Fisher, are you going first? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Beard and members of the committee. Again, my name is Doug Fisher. I am first past president of the Minnesota County Engineers Association. I'm also the Anoka County Highway Engineer. And you should have received a letter and packet that was distributed. I'm just going to very briefly walk through this in support of this bill. Again, the Minnesota County Engineers Association is very pleased to support this bill, as it will provide continuing design build authority to counties and cities in the state of Minnesota as revised per this bill. We believe that design build is another mechanism for us to deliver high quality, high value highway and bridge improvement projects. It essentially is another tool in our toolbox. I just want to, just maybe for the committee's brief understanding or updating on design build versus traditional bid, design bid build, on page 2 of my handout, on the top graphic, I show essentially a design bid build timeline and a design build timeline. The greatest advantage of design build is that it saves time. And when you have a project that extends over a number of years, and when we have cost inflation in construction, saving time will also save money. In the traditional design bid build process, the agency completes 100% of the plans and specs, and the contractor builds exactly what was designed and spec'd. And you can see that this is a long process. In the design build process, the new process, the agency only completes about 30% of that plan, does the required environmental documents, buys the right-of-way, and then goes out to bids. Then it's up to the design build contractor to complete the final design and build the project. So you can see on the timeline, the two blue bars, the award time, from the design bid build timeline to the design build, we move that up so we can get projects in the ground sooner, and then overall the project will complete sooner so we can get those projects complete. So again, the number one benefit is the savings in time. The second real benefit is anymore agencies very rarely have shovel ready projects. Because to have a shovel ready project, we have to have 100% plans and specifications in the drawer ready to go. Well, when it takes about 15% of the construction cost to deliver final plans, that's quite an investment. And a lot of agencies aren't going to take that investment on without having a funded construction project. So, again, the fact that we don't have these shovel-ready projects anymore, design build allows us to have a 30% plan that really is shovel-ready at that point. So it's saving local agencies. The bottom half of that page, again, why would a local agency want to do a design build? Essentially, anything that has options. If it has staging options, if it has construction options, structure options, because again, in the traditional process, the owner, the agency is saying, this is how we want you to correct the soils, what type of bridge we want, how you're going to stage the construction, how you're going to maintain traffic. That's all defined. A lot of times we would do that, and a contractor would come in and said, you know what, if you really would have done this this way, you did this first instead of this first, you would have got a better bid on this project. So, you know, there's a lot of times when there are many, many options, and again, I list some of those, that it lends itself for design build. You'll get a better project, and you'll get a quicker project. So those are the type of projects that we feel are very good for design build. On the next page, I will say that Anoka County was very proud to be the very first locally let design build project in the state of Minnesota. We are one of the very first two or three design build projects let by a local agency nationally. We're very proud of that. And again, this was our CASA 14 projects, about 5 miles long in the cities of Coon Rapids and Blaine. And that project is currently under construction and is going very well. And on the bottom of that page, I think you can see some of the benefits that we are seeing for doing design build. And you have that for your information. I won't really go through that other than we are saving years of time. And we have Blaine High School, middle school, an elementary school. We have businesses. So to turn a 5 or 6 construction year project into a year and a half construction project for just for the benefit of those businesses and schools and the parks is very important. The question might have been asked, why aren't local agencies doing more design build projects? And on the next page of my handout, I just want to briefly explain why you might not have seen anybody other than Anoka County at this time actually undertake a design build. Well, let's just say that it is a new process. And while we try to mimic the MnDOT design-build process just so the contracting community is comfortable with what we're doing, it wasn't as easy as taking the process, erasing MnDOT, and inserting Anoka County. We're different government agencies. We have different statutory authorities and controls. So we essentially had to reinvent that wheel. When we were assigned the first design-build project, we were given the task of creating a template so other cities and counties can do the design build process. So once we're done with our project and we have this template, somebody, Hennepin County, could erase Anoka and put in Hennepin and go through the same process. So we essentially built the process, and again, and we tried to mimic the MnDOT process, and that's been very successful, I think. So that's just a little background on this. Again, we support the changes that are in this bill. It just revises statute, doesn't really change a whole lot from our standpoint. It just removes some artificial barriers, the selection council, so it streamlines the selection process, and again, it removes that sunset date and allows us to do more projects, up to 9 projects, before the program would need statutory authority to move forward. So again, we support the revisions, and be willing to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher, for your testimony. Are there questions for this testifier? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Fisher, I guess I remember when we first did it, we authorized the design build legislation a few years back. We set it up with a limited number of projects so that people could learn how to do it, like you said, build the template. And it looks like now we're going from the crawling stage to the walking stage. Because we didn't want to get far ahead of ourselves and have a lot of people not be able to do it. And so it looks like you're doing this right. So I think I support this legislation, but I just want to make sure that what we're doing here, we're moving from the crawling stage to the walking stage, and hopefully at the end of this we'll have some history that we can look back at and say this is the right way to do it, this is the wrong way to do it, before we let it open enough for everybody to do it.
Mr. Fisher?
Chairman Baird, Representative Nelson. Yes, that's what we're doing. Again, this revision had a 3-year period in there, and again, it's taken us 3 years to get to this point, so we want to strip that down. We want to do 9 projects. We don't want to limit it by time, so we do that. Plus, the original bill said so many had to be on the county state aid system, so many had to be on the municipal state aid system. We remove that obstacle. If a city or county wants to do it, they're not going to be restricted because somebody already did 2 in that category. They're not going to be allowed to do it. We want to do that. And again, we walk through that process by MnDOT now having really the oversight of the council. We developed our project step by step with MnDOT, with the AGC, with the consulting engineers to make sure that, again, we don't have all these varying different processes. MnDOT does it this way, the counties do it this way, the cities do it this way. So we have streamlined this. I think this bill still provides that oversight, and this template now gives everybody the tool to move forward. So
thank you. Representative Biskins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I guess a few questions. Number one, it almost sounded like you were making the statement that this new law gives opportunity for more projects, not less. However, I'm looking at your proposal for 9 design-build projects, yet the previous proposal had up to 15 projects, 10 and no more than 10 from county, state, 8 highways, no more than 10 from municipal. So actually looks like we're limiting. I do notice, though, and this might be to Representative Vogel, it could be to the testifiers, that when we first put this in law, and there's a number of skeptics in the legislature, one of them sitting in this corner of this committee table on design build, but the reason we create pilot programs, as Representative Nelson said, is we have to learn to crawl before we walk, and I can appreciate that. However, crawling infers learning from the crawling. All right. However, I noticed nowhere in the statutes when we created this was there an opportunity for the legislature to actually learn. Are we only using two knees and a hand as we're crawling? Are we using our elbows as we crawl? I don't know how we're crawling right now, and yet we want to take it out of the pilot program stage and into the this is an accepted method, but not quite an accepted method because we're only saying 9. If we are in the walking stage, then why are we limiting it at all? And if this really is, if the data has shown us, which I haven't seen yet, Mr. Chair, and maybe you have, if the data has shown us that this is indeed both fiscally responsible and responsible to the taxpayers in terms of quality, not just faster. Faster is good. I like faster, but I want faster with quality and fiscal responsibility. But I've seen no information that any of those are true. All right. So I'm kind of wondering why. I'm not sure we're even going to the walking stage. It looks like we're going from the crawling to the driving a car stage, right? And I guess I want to know why we're doing that. What are the barriers currently in place? What have we learned from the projects that have happened? Where is this information for the legislature to make good decisions?
Now, this is a good informational question Representative Biskins is teeing up for you. But Mr. Hanisch, are you going to address those in your remarks? Because I know we got into questions before we called on you to speak, or do we need to have Mr. Fisher speak to that?
Mr. Chairman, I think it might be best if Mr. Fisher addresses it. I do have information relative to quality. It's not necessarily the personal experience that Mr. Fisher could speak to on his project.
Hold your comments, then, and we'll get to you in just a moment. Representative Biskins does raise a good question, because some of us have been on this committee for several years, Nelson, Hornstein, Beard, 10, I can think of, and we have seen the evidence from the state pilot project that was approved, I think, in 2000 or 2001, and are relatively convinced that this actually is a pretty safe, sane, and reasonable way to go. However, we're proposing to lift the pilot project status off of county and municipal projects in this particular bill. So let's let Mr. Fisher speak a little bit to the evidence of why we think we can walk, if indeed that's the case. Mr. Fisher?
Chairman Beard, Representative Biskins, hopefully I can answer this. Essentially, it's by limiting it to 9 projects, it still is a pilot program. Once we exceed 9, if once we get the 9 projects, we would have to come back to the legislature to open it up so it's just a normal course of business. So it still is limited. What it removes is the distribution. We are only allowed so many county projects, only allowed so many city projects, so it's just now 9 projects. We didn't want to artificially restrict anybody just because we were out of numbers in that category, so I think it does that. I think 9's the good number. Do we want to do 15 projects before we really take the kind of the pilot process out of it? I think 9's a good, because by that time we'll have a wide variety of different projects, small projects, medium-sized projects, large projects.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative Biskins, follow up.
Very, very specifically to this point, of the 15 original pilot projects that the legislature put into session law, how many actually took place? Was the entire quota used up, was there only one or two projects with the 15 quota that the legislature put in place?
Mr. Fisher, while you respond, Mr. Representative Vogel, if you'd yield to Ms. Finn, too, she can speak to this. Mr. Fisher. Or maybe Ms. Finn can speak to it.
Mr. Chair, to my knowledge, Anoka County is the only one that actually has been let and is under construction. So that's why the original time frame of the pilot program needs to be removed, because we just have not had a wide variety of projects. I believe Ms. Finn can talk to, there was a Rochester project as well.
So there were two limitations on the pilot project, the number of projects and a time, a date certain. Representative Finn, Ms. Finn, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. Just to answer your questions, Representative Biskins, there was an inconsistency in the initial pilot program as it was established in 2009. There was in one place in the bill a limit of 15 projects. In another place, the limit was 9. The local government groups, working in consultation with the Associated General Contractors and other stakeholders, decided to be conservative on the number that we would build, and we all have been working under the assumption that 9 is the number, because we think that would probably give us an adequate snapshot of how the pilot, how it's working, and how this tool is being implemented at the local level. And Mr. Fisher is correct. There has been only one project built, and that's it's underway currently in Anoka, Anoka County. There was another project that was approved, and as it started to move forward, it was determined that it was not necessarily a good candidate for a design-build project, and so the city and the Department of Transportation decided to not go forward using that procurement method because it wasn't working. So what we're asking you for today is to let us finish building the 9 projects. Now that we have the system up and running, and the bill will hopefully take away some of the disincentives to participate in the project by making it the process easier, we would like to work under the new language and finish the 9 projects.
So this will not be 9 more. This is the original 9 and remove the time, the date.
Mr. Chairman, correct. In fact, now there will only be 8 more because we're using one of those 9 right now.
Thank you for clarifying that. Representative Biskins?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can't find in the language the 9, so if you do have the opportunity to point that out to me, that would be appreciated. So it sounds like from the testimony we're going to continue to consider this a pilot program. Obviously, why limit it to 9 if it isn't a pilot program and there's something to learn from it? So the one thing I'd ask Representative Vogel as you move forward with this is consider specifying how a future legislature can learn from these pilot programs so that when they come back, and they most surely will, we have some concrete data on which to make our decisions. I understand Representative Beard is absolutely correct with state design build. We have had that. There was a report back to the legislature. This language has no reporting back from the legislature, which would then give them a reason for why they should lift the 9 in the future, which I'm sure will come. It might take, let's see, it was 2009 and we've had 1 3 years later, and we're now asking for 9. It might be 30 years down the road, but you might come back asking to expand this from 9 to more. So,
Ms. Finn, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, one more statement to that point. There, in fact, is a report already on the MnDOT website, according to Mr. Jonas, who's here representing the department, on the pilot project so far. Additionally, there is some language in the bill as it's drafted to say that the department must evaluate the use of the tool, and it's an understanding on the part of the department and AGC and the local governments that will be forthcoming as these projects roll out.
Thank you. Mr. Burris, can you cite in the bill for Representative Biskins where the 9 is, for all of us, where it refers to the 9?
Mr. Chair, the limitation to 9 is built into the effective date. It was built into the effective date of the original 2009 law as a limitation on the earlier of October 1, 2012, or completion of 9 projects. And then in the bill, you might actually take a look at the amendment. That's where the limitation under the effective date to each of the changes made to the original 2009 session law is put into place.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burris did bring to my attention that we may need to make an amendment to repeal that. Is that correct? That sunset date that's in there?
Mr. Burris, did we accomplish that in the amendment, or did we miss something there?
Mr. Chair and members, what I had noted is that the original effective date from the 2009 session law has not been modified in this bill, and in order to eliminate the October 1, 2012 cutoff of authority to run the program, mm-hmm. that effective date would also need to be amended. So that would be another amendment that will be necessary to keep the program authorized beyond October.
Mr. Burris, would it be appropriate to do that right here, right now, as an author's oral amendment? Or should we put that in writing on the floor or lay this bill over?
Mr. Chair, I would recommend doing it in writing. I could either go put something together, or it could be done on the floor. But it is a little bit trickier to do as an oral amendment because of the way it's amending session law effective date.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, I highly recommend laying this over to continue to work on it, especially in light of the testimony that the department, the language of the department evaluation, has this bill gone out for fiscal note request? Is the department willing to do this pro bono, I guess?
All right. We can ask those, and so we'll then amend the motion whenever we get to the conclusion of your testimony, and we're done with questions then. Representative Vogel, please introduce your next testifier, and if you could make your points succinctly, that would be appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This testifier is Tom Hamish.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tom Hamish. I'm a senior project manager with McGough Construction and Engineer and past president of the Upper Midwest Region chapter of the Design-Build Institute, and I'm here on behalf of the Design-Build Institute. The DBIA is the industry's preeminent resource for design-build project delivery information, education, and training and expertise. We teach effective integration of design and construction services to ensure success for owners and construction of design and construction practice. The use of design-build has doubled in the last 5 years in both terms of number of projects and the value of those projects, and much of that growth has been at the local level nationwide. In fact, almost half of the new design-build laws passed over the past few years granted design-build authority to local governments. Design-build done right consistently delivers projects 6 to 10% more cost-effectively than traditional methods. And this was a study by Penn State and the Construction Industry Institute, and I have information on that we'd be willing to share. We are interested in having design-build done right. We appreciate the steps that Anoka County has taken to make sure that it's being done right. We seriously believe that because it delivers projects more economically, more money is available for additional projects to get done. And on behalf of DBIA and AJIC, we all like to see that happen. So with that, we urge you to support this bill on behalf of DBIA. So.
Thank you. Questions for the testifier, Mr. Hanisch? Questions? Seeing none. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify concerning this bill, House File 2378 as amended? Anyone else want to testify for, against, or about? Seeing none. Mr. Vogel, we're going to lay the bill over as amended. Mr. Burris, would that be best? And then you can make an amendment to the bill as amended. Would that accomplish our purpose when we bring it back next time?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if the committee chooses to lay it over, I can do up an amendment that
we will
add those pieces in.
The committee is choosing to lay the bill over, and we'll have a discussion about that date and make sure we get this done right, okay?
Yes.
Rather than do committee work on the floor, members, you know how I feel about that. We'll do our work here. Anything else from the testifiers? Great. Thank you for your testimony and for shedding light on this topic. Representative Sanders in the audience now. Mr. Wally. Oh, there it is. Sanders. Okay, members, we're going to do House File 2136. There is a delete all amendment on that also, and this will be referred to the Commerce Committee. Mr. Sanders, if you'd like to move your bill, send it to Commerce, and then we'll do your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 2136 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Commerce Committee. With that, I do have a DE1 amendment that I would like to move to put in the shape that I desire.
The DE1 amendment is in front of us. It's a pretty extensive amendment. Is there big changes or a few tweaks? Excuse me along the way, Mr. Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would clarify it as clarifications and some tweaks, but I mean, there is substance to it, absolutely.
Okay. Having reviewed it, members, I'm going to encourage us just to support the amendment to get the bill in the shape with the author. I'd like to discuss it, and then we'll have discussion there. Mr. Wally?
Go ahead. There was a small tweak to the first section of the Delete Everything Amendment that we've talked about with council, and that is to simply add the words at the end of that first section, that is not a late hyphen model vehicle, period.
Mr. Burris, are you aware of this?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Would you report it to the committee, and we'll just incorporate in the DE1 amendment and adopt it.
Yes, the oral change would be page 1, line 8, before the period, insert, comma, that is not a late dash or hyphen model vehicle.
And Mr. Burris, there is a legal definition in statute of what a late model vehicle is, isn't there?
Mr. Chair, yes, and it's being amended in Section 2 of the bill.
That's right in front of us. Look at that. Thank you. Everybody understand and the amendment, the oral amendment to the DE amendment? We'll vote on the DE amendment as incorporating that. Members, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Mr. Sanders, go ahead and present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the committee's indulgence on the amendments. What this bill does is clarify and simplify the vehicle salvage title and damage disclosure section of statute. Section 1 says that, or it amends the definition of a high-value vehicle. We change that from $5,000 to $9,000. Section 2, we modify the definition of a late-model vehicle. By classifying vehicles by comparing the designated model year with the current calendar year instead of the based on model year of the vehicle manufacturer. And we move that to the preceding 5 calendar years. Section 3 is the older model vehicle definition. We modify that as well to consist of all vehicles that have a model year that is older than the late model vehicle's definition. Section 4 deals with salvage titles. It modifies the time an insurance company has before being required to notify the driver and vehicle services. We've changed that from 48 hours to 10 days. We've also raised the cutoff for self-insured vehicle owners and the amount of vehicle damage from the accident from 70 to 80%, because what we're also doing is eliminating the exclusion of the airbag replacement costs while calculating the vehicle damage. So in a sense, it's virtually a push. So now we're including the airbag system in that cost and pushing that out to 80, which we believe is virtually a net, neither a net gain or loss on that, but kind of a push. The disclosure of motor vehicle damage in Section 5, what we do is it takes all of the definitions and modifications that we made earlier throughout the bill, puts them into this section as well. So with that, I have Mr. Wally or Mr. Johnson here to go either to give more background or to answer any questions that the committee may have on the bill as amended.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Mr. Wally or Mr. Johnson, do you feel compelled to further illuminate the bill? Mr. Wally.
Mr. Chairman, only briefly, my name is Kevin Wally. I represent the Alliance of Automotive Service Providers, which is the trade association for the repair industry. Mm-hmm. And just so you have some context for these changes, our association, the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, have been working on the issues of definitions and clarification on salvage title for about 18 months. We've also consulted with the Department of Public Safety, and we've had discussions with the Automobile Dealers Association, and we've tried to come to a set of amendments here that clarify the statute, as Representative Sanders has noted, without doing significant damage, if you will, to the rights of any of the interested parties in an insurance claim in a salvage title circumstance. So I really won't go into much detail on this. I could answer any questions that may arise, and I know Mr. Johnson is here to say the same.
Okay. Members, are there questions for the testifier, the witness, or the author, Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Wally, is this going to, by including the, you know, the change of including the airbags in, unfortunately I had some experience with this summer, but is that going to mean there's more cars that will get salvaged titles or less cars, or is it, as the Representative Sanders said, a push?
Wally?
We think that it's approximately the same consequence. By taking the repair, the separate calculation of the safety restraint systems out and pushing the level up to 80, we think it's about a wash.
Thank you for the question. Further questions or comments for either of these testifiers or for the bill author? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for, against, or about this bill? Seeing no one making sudden moves, Representative Sanders, did we vote on the DE-1 amendment? Yes, we did. We adopted
that
as amended. Further questions or comments? Seeing none, members, Representative Sanders, would you renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will renew my motion that House File 2136, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the Commerce Committee.
That's the motion. Members, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. You're on your way to Commerce. Okay. Members, the next bill we have on our agenda is 2323 today. And Representative Portman in the audience, or Representative Nelson. Oh, there she is. Representative Nelson, would you like to move this bill? At this moment, we're going to hold it over for a possible inclusion, but we may come back and move it separately as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 2323 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. And Representative Hartman, you have no amendments to your bill?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
It's just ready to go. Good deal. Welcome to the committee, and if you'd speak about the portion, in particular, members, Section 2 of the bill is the one we're most concerned about today, but we can, I'm sorry, Section 3. Now that I've talked all about your bill, Representative Hartman, do it again.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this provision was before you last year, and it is for the most part in the omnibus bill right now. It makes some technical corrections to the child passenger restraint language to enable the state of Minnesota to receive federal funds. There's a pot of federal funds that are available to states that have adopted this policy, and we had some problems with the phrasing that we used in our bill that prevented us from accessing the federal dollars. And through the process of getting the bill ready, you know, the same policy provision going through the whole process it goes through at the executive branch this year, it was thought that it should be added to give the Department of Public Safety the express authority to accept the federal funds. So that is the new language.
And just to be clear, Representative Portman, the language that we see on line 1.1819, that's in the bill that exists, the version that exists in the first policy omnibus bill now, which is in Ways and Means at the moment.
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so the lines 2.30 and so on are the new ones that we're considering in this bill.
And, Mr. Chair, I have the Assistant Commissioner.
Deputy Commissioner Ellison, welcome to the committee. Do you want to speak about the bill for a moment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the language in beginning on line 2.30 is not language that that the Department of Public Safety promoted. It was something that MMB asked that we put into effect this year. I do have Keith Bogut is here from MMB. He's here in the audience and he can address it. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that it was simply to clarify that we have the same authority as other state agencies in accepting federal funds. Normally, the way that we accept federal funds is by the statute that says that the governor can accept federal funds and then designate an agency to receive the federal funds. And my understanding that was that MMB thought it would be good to have this language in addition to that language, and Mr. Bogut can address that further.
Okay. Questions to the testifier? Does anyone, Representative Leidiger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much money are we talking about that's in that fund, and what's it going to be used for again, please?
Sure.
Representative Hartman?
Mr. Chair, I believe there's a couple $100,000, I want to say in the $235,000, about $300,000. And what it is when somebody gets a ticket for a fine for not having their child properly restrained, the ticket, the fine goes into a pot of money, and then that money is spent on providing free seats to people who can't afford them. And then the federal money joins the fine money in that same pot and is distributed for the same purpose.
Thank you, Representative Portman.
Thank you.
Further questions? Anybody feel compelled to hear from MMB? We understand what's happening here and why the language is necessary. Good. Representative Hartman, unless you really want MMB to come testify, I think we're ready to lay the bill over for inclusion.
And, Mr. Chair, if you should see any troubled seas ahead for your omnibus bill, I would greatly appreciate it moving by itself.
That will be our assurance to you, Representative. So with that, Representative Nelson, and we will lay the bill over. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For bringing the language forward. Representative Hornstein, House File 2272. We'll do a couple of railroad bills here at the end. Representative Hornstein, if you'd like to move House File 2272 and get in front of us.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure where this is traveling.
At the moment, we're going to lay it over for possible inclusion. Okay. And again, if there's turbulence ahead, we'll move these to the floor on the General Register.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. This is a bill that we have seen before, and it's simply defines the commissioner's duties as it relates to the passenger rail. There are, of course, a number of federal definitions of this, so this simply conforms to that. And it also discusses the specific, in a sense, it's a job description for the commissioner when it comes to the responsibilities that he or she would have when it comes to passenger rail right-of-ways, allocation costs, et cetera. So we have a representative from MnDOT who will be here who can kind of go through the bill and explain it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Mr. Crum, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm here to talk about House File, 2272, which proposes to modify or clarify the Commissioner of Transportation's duties.
Mr. Crum, I'm sorry. If you'd identify yourself for the recorded record, that'd be great because they transcribe this later.
My name is Dan Crum. I'm Director of MnDOT's Passenger Rail Office.
Thank you. Now you can go ahead.
Thank you. I'm here to discuss House File 2272, which proposes to modify or clarify the Commissioner of Transportation's duties related to passenger rail identified in Minnesota Statutes 174.632. Current Minnesota statutes delegate general passenger rail authority to the Commissioner of Transportation. However, some statutory language is dated and doesn't reflect the scope of services identified in the current state rail plan. Specifically, the commissioner is responsible for developing, maintaining a comprehensive statewide freight and passenger rail plan as required in Section 174.03, along with planning, designing, constructing, equipping, operating, maintaining passenger rail service. Amtrak is not listed as an entity that a memorandum of understanding or agreements may be entered into with to carry out statutory duties related to these activities. House File 2272 provides the commissioner with authority to contract with third parties for passenger rail service as authorized under federal statutes. which would provide rights of access to federal rail lines, freight rail lines, and provide labor protection provisions. Contracting with Amtrak provides substantial benefit. However, it also presumes that there are not or won't be in the future other public or private entities, including the freight railroads, that could provide passenger rail service. Currently, MnDOT and our federal and local partners are moving forward with the following corridor development activities: the Zip Rail line, Rochester to Twin Cities high-speed rail service, will begin its initial feasibility work this spring. The Northern Lights Express, the Duluth to Twin Cities 110-mile-an-hour service, is completing its environmental assessment and will begin preliminary engineering and design work early this fall. Twin Cities to Chicago Midwest Rail Initiative 110-mile-an-hour service is in the midst of conducting its Tier 1 environmental impact statement work. And finally, a second daily Amtrak train to Chicago study in cooperation with Wisconsin Department of Transportation and Amtrak will begin in a matter of weeks. In regards to the NLX project and the two Twin City to Chicago routes we're studying, the contracting provisions in House File 2272 will allow the department to enter into agreements to provide passenger rail service potentially with other states, public or private operators, and the most cost-effective and effective means possible. I'm available for questions.
Mr. Crum, two quick questions, and I've got a couple on the list here. Absent this bill, could the commissioner move all these railroad projects ahead anyhow?
Mr. Chair, according to PREIA, which is the Passenger Rail Investment and Improvement Act of 2009, states have to enter into agreements with Amtrak or other operators, and currently the commissioner cannot do that. So these projects could not move forward into operations without this authority.
At the moment, Mr. Crum, there seems to be a lot of money flowing around this committee to these projects that you referenced, several of them in different stages of development. How are we doing that now, or is it only once we get to the operational stage that you need this specific authority?
Mr. Chair, our agreements that we have currently are with the Federal Railroad Administration to access their funds. That's not in terms of operations, maintenance, or construction at this point in time.
That could help clarify some things. Thank you, Mr. Crum. Mr. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess it's just an observation for Representative Hornstein and maybe some other members. There's a few things that are disconcerting to me in the language of the bill, the new language. And I've always had a thing about referencing federal statute in our state statute. Representative Hornstein, I'm sure you, like me, are very comfortable with our current president. But who knows, maybe this November we get some congressman out of Texas as our president, and terms and federal codes can change. But this is a serious question, Representative Hornstein. If the definition of passenger rail in Title 49, Section 24.102 parentheses 4 were to change, does our statute then automatically change with that, or does our statute have to be revised? And if it had changed in a way that we in Minnesota may not be comfortable with, are we beholden to how the federal government automatically changed it by referencing it as such in here? And maybe it's a style thing, but I guess I just feel more comfortable if we are going to come to an agreement in any committee as legislators to reference federal statute, that we state it as it sits in the specific year we agreed, so that if the federal government then were to change a term, a definition in their code, that it would kick in us automatically reevaluating what their changes were and how it pertained to our statute. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is, of course, and I know it was talked about here very briefly, but another thing I am definitely not comfortable with is naming a specific private entity in our statutes, in any statute, be it education law or transportation policy or anywhere else. So I wonder why the need for inserting the word Amtrak when we do specifically state that the agreements with public or private entities would seem to cover the entire universe of entities.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein, would you like
to
respond?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bissons. I think I'll take the first one, and then maybe, and then Mr. Croma may want to comment on your first question, and I definitely want him to take the second question. But Representative Bissons, you raise a good point, and you know, I'm certainly willing to do some problem solving around this. You know, maybe you know, one could insert some language that relates to the point you raised, which is if this changes, if some sort of federal, you know, code changes, then this would have to change with it. I don't know exactly when Mr. Burris would have to work with us on it, but, you know, I think that's a valid question. Now, as to Amtrak, I'll have Mr. Crome respond to that.
Mr. Crome.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Amtrak currently is the only operator in the country, yet Amtrak isn't a wholly public entity or wholly private entity. It's a quasi-public entity that has to go to Congress every year to seek funding for subsidies for its long-distance services. This service is a corridor service, and under PREA that was enacted in 2009, the states would have to contract directly with Amtrak for that service. So the definition of Amtrak is not clearly a public or a private entity. It's that gray area in the middle that's been what some people would say is that their demise over the last 25 years.
Good. Representative Biskins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe one way around that then is to say, or some hybrid form of public-private or something, just to get away from specifically naming a company, I think is probably better process as we break law.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, maybe Representative Biskins, I know you, both of us, I think, don't necessarily like these terms that get thrown about, but you know, maybe it would be public-private partnership or something to that degree.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that many of the projects that were mentioned by the chairman a little bit earlier, many of those are swirling around our bonding projects. I guess I would have some concern given they are substantial sums of money, but would this give the commissioner the latitude of being able to move money around in his own budget to accommodate some of these studies that would need to be undertaken in order for those projects to move forward?
Mr. Crum, can you speak to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, all the activities that my office does are funded through general funds or through the bond funds. We don't have latitude of getting into gas tax money for these efforts at all. So we are implementing projects sequentially and as funding is available at the federal level and at the state level. Currently, we've leveraged over $45 million in federal dollars and have committed approximately $21 million of the 2009 state bond funds for these projects as we move forward. That's where we are now. There is no sustainable funding source for operation, capital, maintenance of these corridors as we move forward. We're initially or consistently in the planning stages for these projects right now.
Follow up, Representative.
However, there could be money in the general fund depending on how it was spent for studies to be undertaken.
Mr. Crum. That was going to be one of my follow up questions. Is the millions that have flowed around this committee now directly to MnDOT, those have been either bond funds that we've authorized in years past or federal funds that are earmarked and sent here, correct?
Correct.
Thank you. Further questions before we lay this bill over? Thank you for bringing it forward, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Mr. Crum, good to see you again.
Thank you.
With that, House File 2272, which had no amendments, is laid over. We'll go to the last bill in the docket today, and I think I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Murdoch.
Yes.
title.
Okay, Chair Beard, would you like to move your bill, please?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House Bill 2428, recommended to pass. Well, we're going to actually lay this one over for now.
I think, okay.
Your game plan might say we're going to pass it, but we're going to lay this over for now, members. But to House Bill 2428, first of all, members, in your packet, there is a DE1 amendment, which is essentially the same as the bill, but does just a couple of things, and perhaps Mr. Burris can tell us where it's different.
Okay, thank you, Chair Beard. Mr. Burris, would you like to explain the DE1 amendment, please?
Mr. Chair and members, there are essentially two core changes under the delete all. One is on the nature of the study, the details of the assessment being undertaken with the study, and the second is somewhat more technical in nature. That under the delete all, it's a study whose findings are then incorporated into the comprehensive statewide freight and passenger rail plan, rather than the results, rather than the work product being a plan that's added on to the plan. So it's a study whose findings go into the plan instead.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. Members, any questions? Chair Beard?
Mr. Chair, I think as we just had in the last discussion, you'll see that the freight and passenger rail plan is an ongoing document that must be maintained, I believe, by the commissioner, and this would be inserted into that, so it'll become part of that.
Members, any questions on the DE1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of DE1, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the DE1 is adopted.
Mr. Chair, there is one other amendment, the A1 amendment. I'll move that, and that's to the bill as amended by the DE1 amendment. And it basically sets an enactment date, which was missing in the DE1 amendment.
Members, any questions, comments about the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? A1 is adopted. So, Chair Beard, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is a bill that basically directs the Commissioner of Transportation and Economic Development, DEED we call it, to conduct a study how we can use freight rail to not only protect but create new jobs in Minnesota. We have over 20 railroads in the state that move over 235 million tons of freight each year. That's about more than a third of all the total freight moving in and around Minnesota, including all the trucks and I believe the ore boats as well. They move grain, ore, coal, aggregate, chemicals, ethanol, food products, consumer goods to and from and through the state from world markets. For many manufacturers, they're a vital link to the customers around the country and around the world, since we're in the upper Midwest and we're kind of on the way between Chicago and Seattle, but we're at the end of the line when it comes to pretty much everything else. Folks, railroads are very important to what we do in Minnesota and how we do it. Over 4,000 Minnesotans work for railroads. Thousands more are employed in industries that depend on rail transportation. It would not exist in this state if we didn't have a robust and dynamic railroad system. I believe the study can help us identify some other opportunities, some things that could be hazards we may want to avoid in the future, and help us create even more jobs because of our outstanding railroad system. In 2009, MnDOT completed its first comprehensive statewide freight and passenger rail plan in 20 years. Believe it or not, members, I do have a copy of the 1984 study at my office at home. It is nothing like the 2009 plan. Anyhow, I did a good job of indexing our railroad system and recommending possible improvements. And, of course, it talked a lot about passenger rail. But we're here today to talk about freight rail and the direct economic impact it has on our state. The study I'm proposing would take that effort one step further. It'll examine how we can use the railroads, and especially our short line railroads, to encourage new industry, business, and jobs along their lines. Members, just a word. The short lines in particular run through small town Minnesota. We know where the main lines are, the big ones. The short lines in particular, however, I think are faster on their feet, have the possibility of more innovation and being more adaptable to what is going on in small town Minnesota. And particularly we're interested that this study helps point out some of the things we can do in our policies and procedures that would help enhance that natural competitive advantage. Some, we have a great examples of how railroads can make the difference in where a business locates and where they set up shop. A study will help identify what those businesses look for, what railroads can do to attract them to their town and their regions. Today with me is John Appetz, counsel to the Minnesota Regional Railroad Association. Mr. Appetz can share some further thoughts on the importance of the measure and stand for questions if you wish, but Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have Mr. Appetz say a few words.
Okay, Mr. Appetz, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is John Appetz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly & Kramer, and we represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, the Short Line Association here in the state of Minnesota. And we appreciate very much the chairman agreeing to carry this measure for us, thinking it's pretty important to job creation, especially, as the chairman said, in rural Minnesota. There's some great examples of how short lines have been the avenue to the world, to our world markets, from small towns all around Minnesota. Winthrop is a great example of that. I was going to go on a bit about how America was built on a ribbon of steel and how during the darkest days of our nation's history, the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln called on the railroads to bring us together with the Transcontinental Railroad, but I'm not going to do that. I think there's agreement that I'm not going to do that, and the administrator of the committee suggests that I not do that today as well. But let me just simply say that railroads have been an economic development tool and can be an economic development engine here in Minnesota for years, and the passenger rail study that the chairman reference is right here. It's on the website over at MnDOT if you want to take a look at it. It's a very, very, very good piece of work that was spent about 18 months were spent on putting it together. It is better than the last one we did about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And lays out a really wonderful vision for passenger rail here in the state of Minnesota. It also lays out, as the chairman said, an index of the freight railroads and some of the challenges they will face going forward as the demand for freight increases here in the state. What it doesn't really do is lay out a vision for how we can use freight rail as a generator of jobs. And that's really what this particular study is all about. So that's what the FRED study is supposed to do, the Freight Rail Economic Development Study. That's what we're calling it. And a couple of our friends over at MnDOT and DEED came up with that as the title. I think we've adopted it. I think it works pretty well, and we hope that you'll bring it forward. There's a couple other folks here, Mr. Chairman, after any questions folks might have. I know Bob Zelinka is here from the Elevator Association, and I know a couple members from Department of Transportation are here, too, if you have particular questions for them. But that's what we're hoping to do, and thanks again ever so much to you, Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, and to the chairman for carrying this bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Appetz. Maybe we'll do questions of you first, if we have any, and Representative Morrow has one.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Appetz. I'm not afraid to talk about what's happened along the Minnesota Prairie Line, which, members, you'll see it's a black line. It goes through Senator Dame's district, Representative Swedzinski's of five counties, and Representative Beard, I've got a nice photo of you and I standing along the Minnesota Prairie Line, and a number of projects have been built there, which I think exemplify the very thing that Chairman Beard's talking about. The ethanol plant along that line has tripled its output from 33 million to 99 million gallons, and the reason why is because we can now do it on rail and not have to do it by truck. New fertilizer distribution plant by UFC does 40 annual tons. 40 annual tons? I don't think that can be right, Mr. Appetz.
Okay,
40,000. New grain elevator, Winfield Solutions, Dairy Farmers of America, they're shipping all the way to Mexico by rail now. And this, Chairman Beard, was some of these projects were funded by DEED, supported by DEED. So this is exactly the kind of thing that we should be talking about. So, Chairman Beard, I want to thank you for bringing this. And I absolutely agree. We need to understand even more about what freight rail means for Minnesota's economy, and the idea of bringing MnDOT and DEED together like this, I think really does benefit everyone, so I just wanted to thank you for that.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the comments, Representative Morrow, and I should point out to the committee the funds that will be necessary, as small as they are, will be coming from a program called what we call the Mercy Fund. So they will be dollars that are inserted either from the general fund or from bond proceeds. And one reason we're laying this bill over today is because there may be a fiscal note attached to that. We'll have to identify the funds, the money coming from that fund, and who it will be available to. So when we get that note, we'll bring that back to the committee.
Okay, Representative Biscuits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chairman Beard. On this handout, and maybe Mr. Abbott's, it can chime in, I'm just looking at the back page, and just for my clarification, paid 2010 property taxes, $28.9 million. Is that to local units of government, or is that the statewide business property tax?
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, that it would be the local taxes to the city, county, school districts. I don't believe that's the statewide business property tax.
That's right. Right. Thank you, Mr.
Members, any other questions? Seeing none. Well, should we have any more testifiers?
If there's anyone I'd like else like to testify for or against.
Yep. Anybody else
to say
for or against?
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself. And
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Zelenka. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Grain and Feed Association. We represent the grain elevator and feed mill industry here in the state of Minnesota. We just wanted to go on record in support of this bill. We have over 600 grain elevators, all of which were on rail at one time. Now we're down to less than 300 that are on rail due to abandonment, aggressive abandonment in the last 30 years, 40 years. We see this as a very positive thing. Grain elevators are, on a lot of short lines, are the main economic driver, if you will, and any way you can add to this economic base on these short lines to maintain their integrity for the future is a good thing, and as such we support this bill and would certainly be look forward to being involved in the process of determining the, and working on this bill, I should say. So that's all I wanted to say. I just wanted to go on record in support of the bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Zelenka. Any questions of the gentleman? Representative Schmanski. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe not to Mr. Zelenka directly, but you had mentioned the abandonment of rail lines. What is our status in Minnesota? Are there lines that are still being looked at for abandonment, or are we trying to reclaim any that have been abandoned to reinvigorate them? Maybe Representative Beard has an answer to that question.
Chair Beard?
I can speak to it as well. After the Mr. Chairman and members, a little history. After the Staggers Rail Revitalization Act of 1978, I believe it was, Mr. Abbott.
That's correct.
The ICC was pretty much reined in. It was miserable trying to get rid of a line that was a loser or that wasn't fitting into a railroad's program. After the revitalization, the Staggers Reorganization Act, railroads began to justify their existence and their route miles. And many times there was redundancy, but many times it was just the way their work rules were organized with their labor agreements with their unions. And it took a while for, I think, the unions and the railroads to learn how to dance together in this new environment. And a lot of lines were shed. Some states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania just bought the lines. South Dakota did as well, just bought their branch lines wholesale, figure out what to do with them later. States like Minnesota allowed counties to form regional rail authorities. In the case that Representative Morrow and I are both very familiar with, three, four, five counties went together and formed a joint powers agreement and bought the line to preserve the core economic activity in their towns, the grain elevators, the feed mills, and a canning plant, and so on and so forth. At this moment, though, I think the railroads have probably justified their existence and downsized or right-sized to about as far as they're going to go. I don't think there's any major abandonments on the horizon. In fact, in some cases, lines that had been preserved through the abandonment process and short line railroads popping up are actually being reacquired by Class 1 railroads. And that's kind of a twist on the thing as the economy changes and fuel costs change. Some of them are being purchased back at very handsome profits. So I think the things have changed there.
Mr. Chairman, may I add just one thing?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chairman, we had distributed a map of the rail system here in the state of Minnesota when we started this. And if you take a look at that, the real faint dotted lines are a lot of the rail dotted lines are a lot of the short lines and railroads that were abandoned after the Staggers Act was passed. And you can see so what sort of rich mosaic Minnesota used to have of railroads. And as the chairman has said, they've kind of justified themselves down to what will commercially operate now. I will add that there is one short line railroad being built today or is about to be operated. up in Itasca County, which will be associated with the steel industry that's being redeveloped up there. So there is one brand new short line railroad developed in Minnesota, and actually the first track that's having been, that's had been laid, I believe, in America in about the last 150 years. Congratulations, Minnesota.
Yeah. Representative Leidinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll be brief. Thank you, Mr. Alpetz. Well, I was looking at those gray lines, too, and I wanted to comment. It looks as though, I mean, just a quick look, that we've lost 50% of these lines. But here's what I wanted to really wanted to ask. Were all these freight lines, those, you know, the gray dotted lines, were these all once just exclusively freight?
Chair Baird?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. In the day, back in the when the railroad industry started in the 30s and 40s of the 1800s, it was the broadband internet of its day. Towns went out of their way to the small town wars broke out over who was going to get a railroad and who would be bypassed. And in that day and age, we were still getting out of the mud and still running around on horses and buggies. Rail transportation in passenger form was the way to go, and there were small town trains that ran for a century until we built highways, all-weather highways, and the aviation industry took off. I don't know that in this state there's been a privately, meaning a railroad-run passenger train that wasn't government-subsidized since about 1971, I believe, when Amtrak came to be. But at one time there were probably small prairie combination cars that ran with freight trains, in some cases what we called BUDs, little rail diesel cars that ran individually, and things like that. But that's been many years, back probably in the 40s and 50s, since they really were in their heyday and started to disappear.
Thank you.
Mr. Members, Chairman. Any other questions? Chair Beard.
Thank you. With that, I guess we're prepared to lay the bill over until we get the fiscal note and are ready to do something with it.
Okay. With that, members, we will lay House File 24 and 28 over and go from there.
Yep. And announcement from here, Mr. Nisley, members, Monday, 12:30, upstairs in Room 5. No meeting Friday this week. And maybe on Monday we'll go over the schedule as we see it unfolding going ahead. With that.
Members, we are adjourned.